can be described to a good approximation by saying that you start with Gaussian initial conditions and then add a small multiple with this coefficient FNL local times the square of the Gaussian field, right? And in Fourier space, that looks like this with two factors of 1 over k cubed, which generates a large three-point correlation squeeze triangles. And there's another shape that is sort of, equally well motivated, I guess, but comes from different physics. Like if you have, say, higher derivative interactions in the Lagrangian or more exotic things like DBI inflation, then you can end up with this so-called equilateral shape, which is actually just sort of a fitting function for something more complicated. This function was just sort of cooked up by Leonardo and Matthias and Paolo Carminelli just sort of be an ansatz for a primordial three-point function that's large in equilateral configurations. But it turns out that these realistic models like DBI inflation are highly correlated to this sort of fitting function shape. So in the talk, I'm only going to talk about FNL local and not FNL equilateral because no one's claiming a detection of FNL equilateral. So you put this three-point function into the initial conditions, and then all the evolution between the initial conditions in the CMB today is linear, at least to within small effects. There is some second-order evolution from gravity, but that will contaminate you at the level of FNL local equals 1, so it's not relevant for analyzing anything in WMAP. And so a three-point function in the initial conditions evolves to some three-point function in the CMB today. You end up with some three-point function among 2D Fourier modes that's proportional to FNL. And the way that we estimate FNL in the data is we just sum over these triples of Fourier modes and sum each triple with a coefficient that's proportional to the strength of the three-point correlation and inversely proportional to the total signal plus noise in that mode. I sort of put some maps here showing in an extreme case if FNL is 3,000, just so that you can see the non-Gaussianity by eye. You can see that putting in this three-point function is taking you from a Gaussian simulated CMB to something with sort of obvious non-Gaussian features. Before diving into the analysis, I think it's useful, like just sort of from the analyst perspective, to have some intuition for the signal that you're looking for. So the local FNL is a signal that if you just sort of plot the bispectrum, you get a signal that is large in squeezed triangles, one where one of the wave numbers is much smaller than the other two. And in squeezed triangles only, then you can say that the sign of the bispectrum is always negative. So there's no, there are some sort of acoustic features, but no actual sign changes in the bispectrum. And there's this separation of scales. Like if you plot the statistical weight, the plot on the left is the statistical weight at the just at the Fisher matrix level with WMAP3 sensitivity per L min as a function of L min of the triangles that you're summing over. And the plot on the right is the statistical weight per unit L max. So what you're correlating one scale, which is like around L equals 10, so you know say scales of several degrees, with with something that's quadratic on much smaller scales, sort of at the scale of the acoustic peak anisotropy in the CMB. So an intuitive way of thinking about this estimator is, so this intuitive picture is sort of hidden when you write down the estimator, but what you're really doing is cross-correlating a like local measure of the power spectrum back to the large-scale CMB. So if you have the local form of non-Gaussianity, you can think of the normalization of the small-scale power spectrum as something that varies on large scales. So if you were the normalization A, you shouldn't think of as a constant anymore, but something that depends on position N. If you correlate that, if you sort of reconstruct this A, if you make local measurements of the power spectrum, say in degree scale patches, and correlate A, which is quadratic in the CMB, back to the temperature on large scales, then that's the bispectrum estimator for FNL. And Ichiro also talked about the trispectrum a little bit. That would be like looking for extra power in A, but not the cross correlation back with the temperature. And the sign convention is chosen so that positive FNL corresponds to a negative correlation between the temperature on large scales and the small scale power spectrum normalization. So you can think of positive FNL as having more small scale power in large scale cold spots. So I like this picture because you can make sense out of plots like this. If you sort of compare the Gaussian simulation to the non-Gaussian simulation and just sort of look at how they differ, you can see the way that they differ is that if a feature like this, where you have small scale power on top of a large scale hotspot, the small scale power is getting smooth. And if you sort of look in a large scale cold spot like this, you can see that the small scale power is being amplified. That What's sorry?
Same CL?
Yeah, that's right. These are right, the same initial conditions, but in the plot on the right, this term F and L is A squared. So McKayla simulates these maps by simulating the initial conditions and then evolving into transitive functions.
But there's a second order contribution from FML to the power spectrum. Do you?
Oh yeah, that's true. Right.
So that they don't have exact same CL, right?
Oh yeah, that would be true. Yeah. That's it. Right, so for such an extreme value of FNL, you change the function.
There have been several estimates recently. So what's made this a hot topic is this wide range of estimates of FNL from the WMAP data. So we started with, back in the one sigma days, this Crevinelli et al. Paper, which for a while was the best analysis. And then Yadav and Wendell came out with the same data set, but an improved estimator. They fixed a factor of 2 bug in the Crevinelli et al. Estimator. Came out with something that was 3 sigma. And then Komatsu et al. Recently, from the WMAP5 data, announced the 2 sigma results. So you can have sort of any number of sigmas from 1 to 3 that you want. And the stakes here are high, because if this was really a clear detection, then it would rule out most models of inflation. I mean, it would really have, I'm sure I don't tell this audience, that it would have great implications for our understanding of the early universe. So I'm going to propose in this talk sort of a well-defined answer to this question of what answer you should take as the value of FNL. Although I give this caveat at the beginning of the talk that this is like work that's in progress. So what I'm really proposing is like a well-defined procedure for ending up with one value of FNL that we can take as the answer. If you sort of dissect this Yadav and Wendell plot a little bit, this is the plot from the paper, then one thing that you might wonder is whether, I mean, there are many sets of error bars in this plot, and the error bar that's being chosen as sort of the bottom line result is the one that gives the highest significance. This is the frequency combination V plus W at L max equals 7 to 50. So one thing you might ask is whether you're making a posteriori choices in this plot. I mean, there are also, you could take this error bar down here that where you would get a result that's only 1.3 sigma. I think it's fair to say that it would be an unfair criticism to say that choosing the frequency combination V plus W is motivated a posteriori. I agree with the statement that you shouldn't use Q-band for measuring FNL because the foregrounds are significantly larger there. And that's why, for example, the WMAP team only uses V and W in their power spectrum analysis. So analogously to the WMAP power spectrum analysis, where you just take V and W and co-add them, you should do the same thing with the bispectrum and just take this combination. But using L max equals 750, I think that choice is less clear. And the reason it's less clear, so it would be clear if the size of the error bars was going down in this plot. But if you look at it carefully, the error bar is smallest, and we see this in our own sort of re-implementation of this estimator. The error bar is smallest at 400 and then rises slowly out to 750. So if you imagine that you hadn't, if you were deciding a priori, if you hadn't seen the data yet, it would be kind of hard to argue that you should use the error bar at 750 instead of the error bar at 400. I mean, the statistical error is, hang on. just give me 1 minute. So the statistical error is getting worse, not by a large amount, but it is getting worse. And it's also true that systematics are going to be a larger component of the signal on small scales, right? I mean, things like point sources and SC are coming in more. We don't expect those to be large, but it would nevertheless, you could definitely make the case that taking the error bar at L equals 400 is the most motivated thing a priori, right? Because by going to 750, you're making both the statistical and the systematic errors worse, right? On the other hand, one could argue that that 750 is the right choice because that's sort of where this thing saturates, right? So you have one value where the estimate saturates, and another value where the size of the error bar is minimized, and they differ quite a bit from 1 to 3 sigma. So I'm not necessarily advocating a particular choice here, right? But I think it's fair to say that a strong argument could be made either way, and the reader of this plot has to choose which error bar to believe. So which one do you think is better?
So, first of all, this notion that the error bar increases as you go up to higher Lmax, I mean, so I've showed, were you here in my talk on Saturday?
Yes.
So I don't actually think that based on, I mean, we did Monte Carlo simulations and looked at the error bar as a function of Lmax. Basically, what we see is it goes down and then stays the same. I think that's, at least at the level of the Monte Carlo simulations that we've done, we don't really see significant rise in the error bar.
I know it's true that if I measure this plot like with a root, I'll see that this error bar is bigger than this one. We do see the same thing in our simulations. If we run log Monte Carlo simulations with the same estimator, the error bar, but it doesn't get much bigger, but it does get a little bit bigger. So I'm not necessarily like arguing from one side or the other here. But what the point of this plot really is to say that what we really want to see is the error bar going down. Sure. So we're not adding noise at the same time that we're adding signal.
Okay. Let me make one more point. This is a slightly historical point, right? So there was a claim detection of a bispectrum anomaly in the COBE data, right? L of 16. You remember all kind of some of this members. And that was based on only a very limited, basically on choosing a particular set of bispectrum modes and looking at those and judging whether, you know, one of those being farther out in the tail compared to Monte Carlo simulations was significant or not. So that was a claim that, I don't know, I remember, it was like something, again, between 2 and 3 sigma claim of non-Gaussianity. And then we actually went and we calculated all of the bispectrum coefficients, even though signal to noise for each bispectrum coefficient is actually quite low. We went and calculated all of the bispectrum coefficients and looked at whether, in that full set of bispectrum coefficients, the one that was claimed to be anomalous, if you take into account that there are many and you have many more chances to be anomalous, whether that was still significant, and that went away. So the significance actually went away by not making a choice how to cut your data. And that was part of the reason why my decision was not to cut the data when there's really no obvious way of selecting which of the LMAX to choose, because the error bar is basically the same. So the idea was to include all of the data. And I think, and then your argument about systematic rather than cutting the data, right? And your argument about systematics and so forth, I mean, I gave a long and boring talk on Saturday.
Lots
of people agree with that, but that's not really an important issue.
Okay, so the point I'm trying to make, I'm not trying to argue that you shouldn't include all the data. I'm just making the point that something is wrong if the error bar is not going down. At the same time that you're adding signal, you're adding more noise.
We all know why that is. It's just that the estimator isn't completely
right. I'll get to that in a minute. So
the first thing that we tried to do is sort of reproduce this result with our own pipeline that was sort of modeled analogously to WMAP3 and the Illinois pipelines. And so we got a result which is qualitatively similar. Like, we see this step between Lmax of 400, around Lmax of 450. Qualitatively similar, but a little bit different in the details. Like, we see, a little bit of this 2.9 sigma comes from a little uptick here, and we see a little bit of a downtick. So that in the end, we get something like 2.1 sigma instead of 2.9. So the reason for this, I believe, is not that anyone screwed up, but just that this estimator sort of appears to be uniquely defined. But if you get into the gory details, you see that there's a lot of sort of arbitrary choices that you have to make inside, like how you weight the different maps and you add them together, whether you use uniform weighting in pixel space or something like inverse noise weighting, how you subtract things like the monopole and dipole from the maps, how you do those fits. And so just different sort of arbitrary choices can lead to a shift in the answer. I mean, we sort of made our own a priori set of choices, and we didn't try to, presumably if we make different ones, we can get up to 2.9 sigma, but we didn't really explore this too carefully. But this is just sort of illustrating another way in which you sort of have to choose what number to end up with. You have to choose the Lmax, and then there's all these sort of hidden knobs inside the estimator that can lead to one number or another. Okay, so another thing we wondered about. So I'm going to talk about WMAP3 for a while, because that's where we've done most of our analysis, sort of for obvious reasons, and then I'll show a WMAP5 result at the end.
They're about the same. They look the same to me.
Okay. They should be, formally speaking, a smaller, right? Because it's optimal.
Oh, no. This is not an optimal analysis. So one thing we were wondering about is, you see this, so this result is being driven by the step around L400. And so we were wondering whether that was,
evidence for systematic contamination. So when I first saw this result, my gut feeling is, I mean, everything looks fine consistent with null until you get to small scales, and then suddenly it jumps up. And so I thought, well, I sort of had a gut feeling that there had to be some systematic reason for this. But what I eventually concluded is that the systematics are probably okay. So to just say a little bit about systematics, you're looking for some systematic which would correlate the level of small scale power that you see in the WMAP data back to the large scale modes or the temperature on large scales, right? And a positive correlation would correspond to negative FNL, right? And you're looking for a correlation that's very small. There's so many modes in the WMAP data that when we say FNL is of order 100, I mean, there's really a prefactor of 10 to the minus 5 when you're multiplying FNL by zeta. So this corresponds to a cross-correlation of 10 to the minus 3 between the large-scale temperature and the small-scale power. So my first reaction is there has to be all sorts of instrumental or astrophysical reasons that you would generate a 10 to the minus 3 correlation, and maybe we could find something that would explain this. One explanation is galactic foregrounds. So one thing that I thought about is whether there seems to be some evidence that the bias to FNL local from foregrounds is always negative. I think that I agree with this statement, but I'm not 100% sure. So you can make a heuristic argument for this, that because there are no sign changes in the FNL bi spectrum, you're always just looking for excess small scale power in cold spots. That if you have any sort of emissive foreground like synchrotron, then in regions where the synchrotron is high on average, you expect to see more small scale fluctuations. And so that heuristic argument would suggest that you would just always bias FNL in the negative direction, regardless of which L's you're looking at, as long as you're looking at squeezed triangles. And that seems to hold up if you just estimate FNL with different masks applied to the data. You know, if you deliberately let the mask not mask enough sky, if you deliberately let some galaxy through, then you see that the bias to FNL is negative, independent of the band. So I think I agree with the statement that the foreground bias is always negative, and so it wouldn't explain, it would make this, you know, a detection like this more significant, not less, if it was large. But finally, foreground templates seem to show that if you have a conservative mask like the WMAP3 KP0 mask or the WMAP5 KQ75 mask, that the foreground contamination is like of order a few. Spending a lot of time on this, I think I agree that the foreground contamination is probably not a problem. The other thing that you might look at is extragalactic things that contribute their own bispectrum to the data. This type of calculation is hard because there are so many possible contaminants, right? So if you write the CMB as the primary CMB plus ISW plus lensing sort of put in terms for each of the different secondaries, then you get a contribution to the bispectrum from each choice of triple. I would guess that the only combinations that are going to correlate to the local shape, where one of the scales is large, are combinations where one of the secondaries is ISW. So you get a cross correlation if you have the ISW. You get a biased FNL if you have the ISW effect on large scales.
I think in SC.
Yeah.
SC. I'm not 100% sure about.
Yeah, well, the thing is that you have a sort of cluster distribution varies on larger scales as well. So, I mean, you don't resolve clusters one by one, of course, but the mean y parameter fluctuates the same way that galaxy distribution fluctuates. So,
right. So, cluster point sources are clustered as zero.
Exactly. So that's what I'm here.
Right. So XC, x equals SC might be is another
thing to check. So if you're getting your cross correlation to large scales through the ISW effect, then in general you would expect this type of secondary to contribute positive FNL, because you'll sort of have more small scale power from things that are correlated to ISW, like SC clusters or point sources. You'll see more of these small scale objects in potential wells, and those are cold spots in the CMB through the ISW effect. And so with the sign convention, that would give positive FNL. These have sort of, since this detection came out, so Dan and Elena, their paper came out today, showing that the ISW cross-correlation with point sources in SC we can expect to be way too small for WMAP. And the largest contribution appears to be ISW lensing. You have more gravitational lensing in potential wells. So I calculated this and gotten a result of order 5, and I think this agrees pretty well with what Asantha and Sarah were getting.
No, because it's 2 SCs and 1 S.
No, I think 3 SCs. I'm thinking of 3 SCs.
3 SCs would be positive, 3 point sources. Mm-hmm. So another possibility is point sources. So you can find claims that the point source bias to FNL is always very small, based on calculating Fisher matrices, where the point source model is to take sort of isotropic unclustered point sources. So this statement, these calculations, I never quite believed, because they're making the assumption that there's no point source clustering or anything on large scales. And then you reach the conclusion that they don't bias FNL where one of the scales is large. So I think a more precise statement is that you would only bias FNL local if you had some reason why the point source density was varying on large scales. So just point source clustering, the fact that point sources trace gravitational potentials that have power on large scales is one possibility. Another possibility is galactic point sources. I was especially worried about this because a lot of the WMAP point source power is unresolved galactic sources. And those do show large gradients. There are a lot more of them near the galactic plane. And in this case, so one thing I should say is you would expect the bias to be negative in general because from this point source clustering mechanism. Because if you have more point sources in regions of greater point source emission. So this wouldn't explain the detections, but we also did some simulations of this and found that sort of for realistic point source models, consistent with NBSS and the levels of point sources seen in WMAP, you get a bias of FNL that's of order 1 or a few. Even if we put in large gradients for the galactic point sources, it just doesn't seem to matter that much. And then we thought a little bit about instrumental systematics, like, for example, beams. The beams wouldn't do anything, wouldn't generate a three-point function because they're linear, but you might worry about side lobes picking up the galaxy. I agree with Ben's argument that large side lobes aren't going to generate anything on small scales. There are no, and non-Gaussianity of the noise in WMAP is also, it looks like, not a problem. WMAP passes all sorts of strong tests of Gaussianity. So we couldn't think of any instrumental systematics that would contribute any significant level of FNL. I've spent most of my time since this paper came out thinking about systematics, but I think I sort of convinced myself that you really can do this analysis, at least at WMAP sensitivities. There's a few things that are shifting things around at the level of FNL of a few, but I think that we can just treat this as sort of a pure statistics problem, like just the math problem of figuring out how to get the best estimate of FNL. Another thing we were wondering about is whether this large step at L of 400 in WMAP 3 was interpretable as a statistical event, right? So the large multipoles above L equals 400 have low statistical weight in the estimator. And so you might wonder if it's in a simulation, if you could ever get this large jump, like a jump of delta FNL equals 40 or so, when you include these small scales. Okay, so this plot, so most of the plots that I'll show in the talk are this plot of cumulative FNL versus LMAX. But this plot is the exception where I've split the LMAX of the triangle into bands, and I'm plotting a separate independent estimate of FNL from each band in LMAX. So this is equivalent to the plot that I showed before, cumulative FNL versus LMAX. It's just showing what FNL you would estimate if you only used each particular range of scales. I'm summing over L. So each band is one band in L max summed over L.
Flat and the other flat.
It's essentially the same analysis, just represented.
This is the derivative.
In this plot, the error bars would be correlated.
This is the derivative of the previous plot.
Oh, okay.
Right. The point of this plot is that you can try to just read off by eye whether this glitch at L 400 is statistically anomalous or not. What you see is that it's within statistics. It wouldn't be crazy to interpret this plot as evidence for a constant FNL around let's say 80, right? Like the chi-squared to this constant is not going to be bad. So this one bin is around 3 sigma. I should say that there's a little bit of
theorist bias here, right? Because if you interpret this as evidence for a constant FNL, everything looks okay. But what would really be interesting is if you had a model that what we really see in the data is sort of this big scale-dependent glitch. So if you had a model that actually predicted that, that would be very interesting.
50 is smaller than 450. At 450, you should have more modes, right? You're counting.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great question. So I mean, on those scales, WMAP is getting noisy. But if you were to just compare this with the error bar.
It's not 450 is the maximum you say in terms of the wave function.
So if you were to compare this with the error bars that you would expect, say, from the Fisher-McHugh calculation, what you would find is that this error bar is a lot worse than it should be. But the reason that the suboptimal estimator is suboptimal is that it is blowing up the errors at it's weighting things so that the error bars are worse at high L than they should be, but summing them into the final FNL estimate with the weights that you would use if you had the optimal sort of Fisher matrix errors. So we sort of played with the estimator a little bit and figured out that's the reason why it's suboptimal. Another question you might ask looking at this plot is why if there's this one point that's 3 sigma and everything else is okay, then why is the overall estimate for FNL 2.1 sigma? That's what we get at LMAX 750 is 2.1 sigma. And the reason for that is that this error bar is just being summed in with more statistical weight than it should have given its error.
Kendrick, is the problem that you're using uniform weighting in that the validity of that approximation is breaking down as you get close to L of 500?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So it's actually true that this large jump
that you see if you vary L max at L max of 400 is within statistics. But the reason that you can get this large jump and you have to choose between these two values at L max and have sort of qualitatively different results is again because this estimator is suboptimal and assigning too much statistical weight to this band.
We also have the five other bins that are exactly on top of the. Yes, it's true that one. So you could also talk about this. You have to consider the other bins in your statistical assessment of whether all of this sums together into a 3 sigma result. Another way, I don't think the discrepancy is quite as large as your. The discrepancy between the one bin giving a 3 sigma and the total being 2.1 sigma is not quite as large as you're saying. And not entirely due to the suboptimality of the estimator, but it's also because you have six bins and five of them are okay and one of them happens to be off. So, I mean, if you talk about statistics, just the statistics, out of six bins you expect one to be off by 3 sigma with more probability than just having one number being off by 3 sigma.
You would still just average. I mean, if you average these with inverse variance weighting, you'll end up with less than 2.
Less
than yeah. So okay. So here's sort of a precise statement. So we see.
Previous transparency. So the previous plot. So the feature you see, you bend the data between 400 and 500.
Yeah. Right.
And you use the squeeze on that.
Yes. Exactly.
So the question is, how it's not squeezed at all. How can it take such a big value?
Sorry. This is where the two of the L's in the triangle are between 400 and 500.
Well, that's
and the other and the other one is small.
Well, you always
the range
fix
of the other one.
Sorry.
What is exactly the other one? The range of the other one.
Of the small L.
Yeah.
The median multiple and statistical weight is like around 10. Okay. So if you did have an optimal estimator, and then it would the point I was trying to make with this plot is that you can get this large jump. You get a jump of like of FNL equals 40 between say 300 and 500. Again,
because the estimator is a little bit suboptimal. So if you it would be sort of impossible to get this big jump if you had an optimal estimator. The probability of getting a delta FNL equals 40 jump in that range would be more like 4 sigma. What I have been doing is sort of giving different motivations for constructing the optimal estimator, and that's what I'll talk about in the rest of the talk. So all of these sort of problems and reasons that you have to choose between this range of results from 1 to 3 sigma, all are arguments for constructing the optimal estimate. So
of a scale-dependent non-Gaussian, where there's a jump at some scale in FNL, then that model is prepared at 4 sigma level to no non-Gaussianity or to is that?
So I should qualify this carefully. So given the results from the suboptimal pipeline, you would say that you would prefer that model at something like 2 to 3 sigma. So it's a little bit difficult to define the statistical significance because you're making a posteriori choices, right, by where you set the endpoints. So this looks high, but it's not real. I think it's really not an
anomaly. That's 4 sigma is what it would be.
Yeah. So if that same jump delta L equals 40 like held up to implementing the optimal estimator, then it would help. Okay. So the point I'm trying to make is that there are a lot of arguments for constructing this optimal estimator. So first off, you can shrink the error bar, which is I think no one would say is a bad thing. So in this, when you're sort of in this 2 sigma marginal detection regime, then so the optimal estimator, if you try to forecast what the error would be,
you would guess that you could get to delta L FNL equals 21. So for that's improving the error bar by a factor of 2/3. So if you're at the 2 sigma level, that's definitely an interesting thing to do. The second argument is that the optimal estimator is unique, and there are no arbitrary choices. So it's just a way of getting everyone to agree on one number. So if two people implement this estimator, since the noise model has been specified by WMAP completely, there's just a unique implementation. And if two disagree, then somebody has a bug, and we can figure out who's right and who's wrong. So there's no posteriori choices at all. And another thing is that if you are optimally weighting everything, then that just tends to stabilize things. Like you just couldn't get this, you just wouldn't be able to get this jump of delta FNL equals 40 that's really driving this, taking you from a 1 sigma result at low L max to a 3 sigma result at high L. Okay, so we've implemented the optimal estimator, and I'll show a very preliminary result that you shouldn't take too seriously at the end of the talk, where I do get delta FNL equals 21. I'll say a little bit about how this optimal estimator is constructed. So I've been saying so far that the previous results that I've shown were from suboptimal estimators, but I didn't actually say how they were suboptimal. So the difference is just involves solving this signal processing problem. So you would construct the optimal estimator by taking the WMAP data, the WMAP map M. So I guess the WMAP data is really one map at each frequency channel. And then you just weight the data by its total inverse signal plus noise. So S and N are matrices, the signal and noise covariance matrices. And I mean the matrix inverse here, which is combining the noise covariance, which is diagonal more or less in pixel space, and the signal covariance, which is diagonal in harmonic space. So it's sort of a non-trivial thing to implement. So you apply this filter that just filters every mode by its total covariance. And then once you have the filtered map, then there's an FNL estimator that I won't talk about in detail, this thing with the trilinear and linear term, that you can think of intuitively as just cross-correlating an estimate of the small-scale power in this map back to the CMB on large scale. Okay, so the suboptimal estimator that everyone has been using just differs from this only in the first step, right? So instead of optimally weighting every mode in the data, some heuristic procedure is chosen that is sort of fiddled with until it gets the error bar as small as you can, sort of within your ability to fiddle with it. That's used in place of this inverse signal plus noise. And then once you have chosen this filter, then you apply this trilinear minus linear construction to estimate a value of FNL. So the only ingredient that's missing is just implementing this black box that takes a map and multiplies by the inverse signal plus noise covariance. And that is really painful, but if you sacrifice sleep for a few days, you can even do it at a conference. And the technique that we used is this conjugate gradient inversion with a preconditioner defined by multigrid that I had thought that I invented in a lensing paper, but then Wei Li at some point pointed me to a paper that he'd written 4 years ago that proposed the same idea. One nice feature of this filter is that the noise covariance can be anything that you want it to be. So you can include features of the, you know, sort of arbitrary features of the data in the noise model if you want to filter out modes, for example. So I was able to run this pipeline once before the talk, and so the noise model that I chose was sort of the most conservative thing that I could think of. What I put into the noise covariance N is the WMAP detector noise. That's diagonal in pixels. And then I apply the sky cut. So in this formalism, the sky cut is treated as part of the noise covariance. You just treat each pixel that's masked as an infinite noise pixel. In implementation, you work with the inverse noise matrix instead of the noise, and so you treat those as zero modes. In each WMAP map, I marginalize an independent monopole and dipole. So the way that that marginalization is implemented is just by, again, by treating those modes as modes of infinite noise or zero modes in the inverse noise covariance. And then finally, in each WMAP map, I marginalize the three WMAP foreground templates. So there's a synchrotron, free-free, and dust template. And I marginalize them independently in each WMAP channel, so I'm not assuming anything about the frequency dependence. So this foreground template, I should say that if you have this foreground template marginalization in your noise model, then the estimator is just not using those modes. So each template corresponds to one mode in the data. And by putting them into the, by marginalizing them in the noise covariance, you're just telling the estimator that it's not allowed to use that mode. So one nice thing about treating the templates that way is that there's no difference in running on foreground cleaned maps, where WMAP is fit out best fit foreground templates, and WMAP raw maps. So I think that this way of treating the foregrounds is a little bit better than trying to clean the maps, because it's just not using that mode of the data. It's just throwing away the amplitude. So I use the same prescription as WMAP for the foreground templates. So the dust template comes from FDS, the free-free template comes from H-alpha, and the synchrotron template comes from differencing K-band and K-A-band. Okay. So the idea here was to just use WMAP parameters, but be as conservative as possible. Okay, so before I show the result of the optimal analysis, we did a check where I just ran the suboptimal pipeline on the WMAP5 data to compare with Ichiro's results. And they compare reasonably well, although there's sort of a constant offset here of delta F and L equals 10, which I again would assume is just due to like different weighting choices within the suboptimal estimator. So one nice thing about Ichiro's paper is that he has an appendix where he actually spells out like exactly the way he implements his estimator so that a monkey could implement it. And that will mean that we can actually like try to reproduce, we should be able to reproduce his results exactly. So we'll be able to track down whether this delta F null equals 10 difference is just due to these weighting choices. Okay, so I've run the optimal pipeline once, and this is what we are currently getting. If I run with the optimal analysis, I get this small, the error bar of 30 goes down to 21, and we're currently getting a best fit value. So this is stable in L max, and we're getting a best fit value of 22. So at the moment, we don't see a detection. We're just getting a one sigma result of F and L. But I should definitely emphasize that we have lots of checking to do. We've only run this pipeline once. We want to check things like how much of a difference the foreground template marginalization makes, try different cuts on the data, different frequencies, and so on.
That must be. This must be a bug in the plot that I didn't notice. I definitely understand the objection.
But I think the question is the error in the y-axis label or in the red type?
you did say
the result is preliminary.
Okay. Well, that is a little embarrassing. So I should try. So why don't I make this plot correctly? Yeah. Show it after the next plot.
probably it's a factor two because the error is also twice the error.
Yeah. Right. It's proper.
So, have you been into different maxes or not?
This is cumulative, so I think that there's a factor.
You're showing one sigma error bar?
Yeah.
Okay,
so I'm wondering if there's a jump spell in between.
Oh, so you probably just use the same plot script as we had for the previous plot, the same range. Probably just using the same plot script as we had for the previous plot, because the previous plot had the same Y range.
Okay, I can try it. Okay, so you should ignore these error bars, but this is the number that we're getting at L max or something.
Well,
derivative plot.
So that I haven't made, but I guess I didn't really make this plot either. But I know that the result is pretty stable, so I don't think it would show any features. You can see that in Ichiro's, or in Ichiro or my our WMAP5 analysis. So one thing that changed in WMAP5, and going through WMAP3 to WMAP5, is this jump at LMAX of 400 is not really there. I mean, I guess you can see a little bit of a jump, but it's much smaller. This big jump that was driving the WMAP3 result seems to be gone at WMAP5.
Kendrick, did the previous analysis see this jump between 250 and 300?
So I output these numbers from my pipeline, but I haven't been able to find them in papers, so I haven't been able to compare them.
So wait a second. So what is this plot now?
So this is WMAP5 in my suboptimal pipeline.
So your suboptimal.
Yes, right.
So this is what it says. Okay. Because it's interesting. I mean, the actual structure in the function of L max is very similar to your optimals. You basically get. Can you go back?
I haven't got any of those.
Right, you get this exactly the same pattern there. So maybe this is just maybe.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. A little too much tiger paste. Okay.
Well, see the other plot then in between two other next talk.
Movement from delta FNL of 30 to 20 comes from just the noise, the fact that the noise weighting, that you cannot treat the noise as a white, whatever, as some simple beam model, but you have to take the non-stationarity on the sphere into account.
The anisotropy of the noise.
Yeah, that's non-stationary, whatever.
Yeah, that's right. It's some combination of the fact that you should use different weighting of the channels at different values of L, and the fact that the noise is higher or lower near the ecliptic poles.
Part of the anisotropy is already taken into account by the estimator that we used. So it's just that our estimator does not perform the optimal weighting of function of L.
Like
just
as and in this case, like
do you see any effect and any sensitivity to different choices of R sampling? That's still a choice you have to make. How exactly to do that interval?
We just oversampled it. I mean, that's just a case where you have to check that it's converged. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Kendrick, you're gonna make a new plot for sure.
Yes.
Or we can even throw the participants.
Okay, let's thank Kendrick again.